Aloha, mud babies, pod people, and inhabitants of the planet Earth. It is I, your tiki leader, Steve Mudflap McGrew. I am in Fort Worth, Texas this week, working at Hyenas Comedy Club, one of the best clubs in the nation. If you get a chance, if you're in the area, make sure you check out Hyenas Comedy Club. Got a great show for you today. Somebody that I started comedy with back in Houston. Yes, that's right. One of the Houston boys, the Texas comedy guys. Won't say outlaws. I was not in that group that splintered off. But yes, we were all the Texas boys. We all started together. Hicks, Kennison, Pineapple, Mike Vance, Steve Epstein, just goes on. I know I'm missing somebody. Danny Brown. We were all together down here in Texas. And I'm lucky enough today to have on the show Carl LeBeauf. Now, Carl was one of my favorite comics, and has been for years. When Carl started, I was blown away at the talent he already possessed when he started stand-up. And I've got Carl will be the guest today. He'll be coming up here to my room here, and we will get this show kicked off in just a second. But I want to say thank you to you guys for listening to the podcast. You guys, you inspire me every day to come up with something new, something to talk about. You guys are the reason that I love living life. Seriously, I love entertaining you people. I love giving you something to listen to. And I just want to say that I'm grateful for you. Is that weird? I hope not. Anyway, here is today's show with Carl LeBeauf. Are we all done? We cleared out, done?
So.
All right, we are sitting in the hotel room of the Hilton in Fort Worth. This is, we used to be called the Hotel Texas.
Yep.
And I'm sitting here with Carl LeBeau. Some of you may know him as C.D. LeBeau. No. Most of you don't know him as C.D. LeBeau. And I'm going to find out in a minute why Carl attempted to go by C.D. LeBeau.
Uh-huh. And, at one point.
At one point. Uh-huh. But yeah, here we are. And this is, as we came off the elevator,
yeah.
You saw the Kennedy picture right there.
You know, for those of you listening here, we're in Fort Worth, Texas. And, you know, anybody that was alive to experience that, I was a little boy. I was 5 when it happened, when Kennedy was shot. So I remember my parents completely melting down in front of the TV. And, of course, that was what America did for the next 6-7 days, you know,
was
watch that whole thing transpire.
Where were you when Kennedy was killed?
Exactly. So to walk off that elevator and see this is the floor he stayed on, this is the hotel that he was at just moments before he went, you know, that's a powerful picture, isn't it?
I know.
It's a stark moment on the wall.
I know. So you actually told me earlier you got to meet, shook hands with Kennedy, right?
Yeah, I was a little boy in my dad's head. At some other point, I must have been 3, I guess, and my dad ran across Kennedy, and I got to shake his hand. I was on my dad's head, on his neck.
Uh-huh. Uh-huh. Do you remember that moment well? I mean, is it one of those deals?
No, I have no memory of it whatsoever. It's like the 80s for me.
are the 80s a blur?
Yeah, they all just melt into one day for me. Just kind of went quick.
So for you, the 80s were like the 60s. I hear so many people go, well, if you can remember, you weren't there.
Right. Yeah, exactly. Well, the 80s were. For comedy, rock and roll, Sunset Boulevard, you know.
Well, let's get the history of Carl LeBeau.
Well, my history, we're getting yours too.
That's what I was going to say. Well, we'll back it up here. We met years ago at the Houston Comedy Workshop.
Mm-hmm.
We all sort of started together. And
when we didn't know, you know, like, I think I want to do this. Remember that feeling?
I do. I totally remember I think I want to do this because I was working as the cartoonist at the Houston Paper.
Okay.
And my friend Bill Hines, who drew Tank McNamara,
yes.
His girlfriend worked for the improv side over there.
Right.
And he got me to go to the club, and I saw it, and I fell in love with comedy. And I was like, I really would like, y'all have an amateur night? Oh, this would be very cool. Totally. I remember totally just falling into the situation.
Well, I left home and drove up. I lived in Galveston at that time. I used to run a Shell station. And I had keys. I wore so many keys in my right pocket, hanging on my right pocket, that it wore jeans out within a month from the keys hitting the sides of my leg, yeah.
Did you have one of those things you could pull and retract?
Because you couldn't have an open bathroom because, you know, people would go in there and shoot up. So I had to have the bathroom key on me. So when somebody's going to use your bathroom, I'd walk around the corner and open it for them.
Like a concierge.
But I knew the key
from
feel.
Let me get that for you.
I knew the key from feel. There it is. And it hit my pants. Yeah. I'd walk off with power.
So were you like one of the youngest managers of a Shell station ever?
Yeah. My dad retired from the Air Force in California, and I moved down there to help him. I'd been studying acting for 3 years at that point. So I was just about 20.
That explains, see, I always wondered why you were so good when you first started. And you've been one of my favorite comics forever. And I'm avoiding the situation, we can talk about it later, because I don't want to ever bring out who our friend is.
Yeah, yeah.
And so when you burst on the scene, I was like, this guy's so good right off the bat. But you had the improv skills that added to your stand-up.
I live 4.5 hours away from Los Angeles. And so I used to have to drive twice a week to L.A., do a six-hour class, and then drive home and then be at work at 6 the next morning. So I did that for a little over a year and a half. And because I couldn't rehearse scenes with other actors, my teacher would say, you know, I want you to write something this week about your first time in L.A., what that felt like to you, what you see here, people on the street. Just pick something and give me a 10-minute monologue.
Yeah. And you became very good at riffing.
Became good at riffing. I got over shyness. I got into character stuff because I had to do characters to tell people who I had seen and what I had seen, because L.A. was new to me. I was just out of high school.
Yeah.
So to be protected by as an Air Force child all over the world on bases, you know, to all of a sudden hit L.A. and it was just different. You know, the homeless living out there and the people, you had the hookers and the porno houses on every corner back then and all that stuff that was just so, you know, big. It was so huge. And so I would drive down, I'd get coffee somewhere and I'd be working on these monologues all week, and that's where I developed performing in front of an audience, which was a class of, you know, 30 other people.
Yeah, and that's where you developed the fly and the ambulance.
Yeah.
Was that one of the places, or was that a much later? Because I remember that early bit is still one of my favorite comedy bits of all time.
Yeah,
I
didn't create the fly in acting class. I created it there because I was sitting back watching all of us do stand up for the first time after the room was built. And I realized that little spotlight they had on our wooden wall. To me, it just, because to look out the front window, which was all glass of our club, and see those night lights there and see the moths hitting those lights. And I was sitting back on probably the second time I performed there, and I saw it and went, it made sense to me. I can do that I just saw outside. And that's how I created the piece. So I walked on stage and I'd say, everybody, behind me is the night light. I'm a moth. And I did it so, I'm a professional actor and this is going to be very important.
And it was.
And then I walked, you know, about 20 paces back to the bar, flapped my arms twice and ran as hard as I could right into that wall. Spun around on the ground, got up and went back and did it again. Yeah.
Over and over.
Yeah. And you know, after months of doing that, I used to have to go home and pull the shirt off my elbow because I had splinters all the way into my skin. I eventually
get it stapled.
If you see some of the old photos of that wall, you'll see spots on the wall that are raw on the grain wood because my elbows had crushed so many times. Yeah.
So that bit basically became a staple of the Carl Blabow act there for a while.
Well, and also back in those, you know, I didn't have a lot to say.
None of us did.
Yeah,
and as you recall,
at 20, you know,
a lot of us would sit in the back and go, "Just try it. Why don't you try that?" I've been thinking, "Why don't you try it?" Like
that was my favorite part, was the fact that we all pushed each other and encouraged. You know, we were lucky,
right?
You know,
we were all sort of different. And this is something I don't see today. And I tell a lot of comics, other comics used to support each other. Mm-hmm. Like you'd go, "Hey, I wrote this joke," but it's more like you. You know, this doesn't fit me. Well, right. Or I thought of this. This would go better with you. Uh-huh. And there was a whole lot more of that now. I feel everybody now is just like, take care of myself.
And, right. And that's what was different about it. And I think magical for us. As it was in Boston for that original crew, and as it was, you know, New York for that original crew, and L.A. for that original crew. You know, it was very lucky to be on that opening time.
Yeah.
I mean, because it wasn't, what, 5-6 years later where clubs exploded.
Right.
All over. But back then, that was the first Texas club, wasn't it?
First comedy club first I remember in the area
in
at all.
Yeah.
Now, do you think, you just brought it up and made me think about it. Now, like, Boston has its definite thing of Boston comedy,
right.
Boston style.
Right.
New York has it style.
Yeah.
Do you think Texas
time
we had?
I don't see it, but people tell me that. People that have been fans of ours,
yeah,
yours, mine, and our other friends, they all say, you know, you guys are, there's something about you. There's an opinionation. There's a expression. You express yourself different, you know. And I don't see it. We don't see it because we've lived it.
Yeah, and I've had it sort of described to me as you guys like we're fighters. It's like there's a joke every a certain
uh-huh.
amount of time.
Uh-huh.
It's not like, okay, here's a thought. Okay,
right.
Let me look at my notes. There's a, like we just get out and do it. It's just
uh-huh.
like it's like slamming the bag. That's
yeah.
how somebody described the Texas thing to me. Because I watch you and it's the same way. You're sweating. You're working. You're having fun.
To me,
it's always
been a concert. You know, it's like. If you go to see somebody in concert, they're not going to, you know, be calm and cool all night. I mean, they're going to get into it. And that's, you know, that's what I always thought comedy was, rock and roll. So,
and it was in the 80s.
Yeah, right.
Rock and roll. People say, I wish I'd have gotten in it in those rock and roll days.
Right. But, you know, you create that.
I think it's coming back around. I think the rock
sure
and roll kind of attitude now is back for comedy.
Yeah.
Because people... They're coming back to the clubs. Comedy is...
Country's in a state where you need to express yourself differently. You know,
gotta laugh.
You got to. And people are losing jobs. People are always... Everybody's a month away from losing everything.
Yeah.
Always. No one's safe. So that's in the spirit of comedy. So,
do you find that the audience have changed lately? Do you see them being a little bit
more... You know what's interesting? I guess if... the last couple of months, it seems to me, I've had more people... In the whole time I've done stand-up, that have said, this is my first time to a comedy club. So I think maybe that surgence of so much on TV that you don't need to go to a club anymore,
uh-huh.
I think that those people are out, or the, you know, 20 to 30 group is being pulled into it for the first time. It's interesting.
Yeah. Yeah, I think that we're getting a lot of new people because of Twitter, and there's a lot of humor on Twitter,
uh-huh.
and there's a lot of now... like YouTube, you could create your own little videos or film it at a club and put it on YouTube.
Right.
You didn't have to, you're not sitting around waiting for comedy on the road to
right.
give you some type of exposure.
Uh-huh.
And I think
that's
people
true.
Are finding comedy again.
Yeah, well, isn't it great that they walk up and they go, yeah, I looked you up, that's why I came.
I had somebody
that's
say
great.
That to me last night.
Uh-huh.
They said, I looked
that was
up
me.
Your
remember when I walked up to you?
No,
hey, I looked you up and realized you're
right.
a friend of mine.
Oh, I hadn't seen you in years. But somebody did say that to me last night. Uh-huh. I thought that was funny. That was their first time ever to a comedy club, ever.
Uh-huh.
And they said they loved it. They're
yeah.
going to be
back. So they thought
back.
They'd look us up first and see what you do.
Is it really worth going down?
Right. Isn't that great?
But again, now they can look you up.
Yeah.
Now they can go, no, he's not really our kind.
Right.
He's a little bitter. He's bitter.
It's now they can look at when they want to serve you. I got served for divorce at a club right when I got off stage.
Did you really?
Yeah. And it was such a good serve. And I wanted to tell the guy that I appreciated it as an artist. I appreciated the trick. But he thought I was so mad, he ran out of there. But I got off stage at the Improv. And I was surrounded by people I hadn't seen in many years. And it was a good gaggle, you know what I mean?
Yeah.
So it was a mixture of friends and crowd coming out. And we were all shaking hands and talking. And somebody on the outside got my attention. And when I looked out, he gave me this look and said, you're Carl LaBeouf. And I go, yeah. He goes, no, you're Carl LaBeouf, right? And I go, yeah, I am. He goes, you've been served. And he hands me in front of everybody.
Oh.
And he hands me the serve. And I went... Oh, man, you got me. That was good. You worked it in on my ego, the fact that I just got off stage.
You thought you'd been recognized?
I thought I'd been recognized by somebody that knew me. Do you remember when we used to live next to each other? And, you know, I thought that was where it was headed. You
yeah.
know? You're Karl LaBeouf. He was just stunned, I thought. But it was just an acting job. Never get served in L.A. because they'll send an actor.
Oh, will it? Was it so, did you think he, like,
Well, they're servers slash actors, just like waiters.
Yeah.
You've been served, but would you have time for a read a script?
You've been served, and you've been served. Here's your nachos.
It's about a guy who serves people.
Oh, yeah. Everybody is a waiter, a cab driver, mm-hmm. or something out there. It's like in Nashville. You got to take. I'm a songwriter. Oh, really? Yeah, you know.
Yeah.
You ride in a cab. Yeah. You know, what are you here for? I'm working there. Oh, I'm a songwriter. Really?
Yeah.
You're driving a cab. That's what I see.
Uh-huh. Right.
But they're all trying to. And I sort of had that trouble in L.A. When I first went to L.A. and signed with the agency out there. Right. They're always like, "Well, you're never here. We can't get you to an audition because you're never here."
Right.
And I go, "That's because I'm not a waiter. I'm a comic."
Yes, right.
And I'm out working the clubs, and that's why you signed me, wasn't it? Because I was a comic. What do you want me to not work and not get jobs from you either?
Yes.
And I really did feel like they want you just to sit around. They want you to just...
Don't you think that the agency should have a more truth-bearing, like, listen, we'd really like to give this a shot. We like what you do, but we don't know what to do with you. We've never had on anybody who's a real free spirit. We're just really used to the guys that are right around the corner from us, and they'll just go
do whatever the hell we tell them
because they just want to get work. So you seem to have like a set mind and kind of a directional thing about yourself. You have a look, which lets us know that you are already set in a direction. So we'd like to waste your time for 3 or 4 years, if you don't mind, and learn from you. But we
is that okay with you?
Yeah, but we won't be able to help you much.
here's what we're going to do, though. We're going to act as... pretty much a post office box.
Yes.
That's what we're going to do. People are going to...
We'll give you mail and things like that when you get into town.
Right. We'll tell you that somebody... asked about you.
Right.
And matter of fact, we can package something and send it out, just like you could at the Express office.
Right.
We'll package and send out stuff for you.
You guys going to send me out on anything? Well, there's nothing really
nothing,
your type that's come in.
Not right now.
Okay.
Nothing looks like you. Hmm. Okay. Thank you. All right. I'll talk to y'all next week. I used to go in. I used to go in so pissed off because I used to get just worked up, and I'd go into the office of. I don't even know if I should say the name of somebody, but I go in. It was the big guy.
Sure.
The big guy, and I would just be like, I'd be angry, but it would be greeted with joy, and I'm so glad to see you.
Yeah.
You're one of the funniest guys I know.
Kept that going.
I'm working on. Patted me on the back, spun me around, and I walked out the door smiling.
Yeah. Signed. Yeah.
I love these guys. I'm so happy I signed with them. But I just went from I'm ready to just slam my fist down and say I quit.
Right.
But they could just grease you and spin you.
Yeah. Well, that's why, you know, everybody, all the comics that ask you, you know, I want to get an agent or I want to get a manager right off the bat. It's like just. Let them come to you. You know, when you start making noise, they'll come to you.
Well, Don Barnhart, I'm sure you know Don.
Sure.
Don had said a while back, if the manager, agent manager that you really want isn't interested in you, but the agent manager that is interested in you, you don't want.
Exactly.
So it's a weird kind of... How is the perfect match? Where do you find that perfect...
Impatience, right? And patience is hard to grow into.
True.
You know what I mean? I mean, it takes so many years before you become really patient because you start to know yourself. And I think once you know yourself, that's the biggest thing you can get in this business because you'll always have your integrity.
And then you're too old for Hollywood.
You're not. Yeah, everybody has a different length of time to get to that integrity.
Yeah, you've got to be. You've got to be
confidence in that. Belief in yourself and all that other stuff.
That's why you got to be in your 20s, stoned on pot, and just
not care.
Mellowed. I don't care, dude.
It's happened.
I know so many
guys, yeah. I was just sitting there stoned talking to a guy and he signed me, man.
Yeah.
What?
It was the weirdest
thing. In 8 movies. What?
Isn't it?
Yeah, yeah.
So do you ever feel like you got semi passed up every once in a while, like like just in a pine car derby kind of thing where you were running good and all of a sudden a little car shot.
You know what I've realized from looking at my life is I've always been a good friend to people that became very famous. I've always been a good writer for people that became famous. I've always even in school and things young, I've always been a part of the scene. What I call the scene.
Yeah.
It's not that it's popular or anything else. It's just that it fulfilled me.
Right.
Whatever that was. So, you know, at one point I had a band when I was in seventh and eighth grade. And we got
called?
I don't remember the name of it now. I know it was corny, but remember the name of it. But, you know, we got so good, we played high school dances and stuff. And we were kids, so our parents had to come with us to do gigs.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, I was guitar, and another buddy of mine was guitar, and then my friend, Danny McFadden, who's now back in my life as a buddy, because this was in Japan.
You know, all places. Did he run into, I think I met him in Vegas with you.
Yes.
Yes.
Yes, yeah. You met Danny in Vegas. Well, he was my drummer. So George Gumbrett and Danny McFadden and myself had a band. And, you know, just from meeting these guys in class, talking to them at school, their fathers were officers and pilots, and my dad was, you know, a staff sergeant and brilliantly funny. Had the best attitude of any dad. So all the kids hung out at my house. My dad had the best stereo, the best records. He just loved music. So I was raised around phenomenal music, and I just wanted to play an instrument. So I got a guitar at 12, and by the time I was 13, 14, I had a band. And we got really good, because that's all we did all day is play, like, you know.
That's what you do.
All day long.
Just lay around and jam. And we're going to be stars.
So I guess, yeah. Well, it's just I wanted to play.
Did you actually play in a garage? In your actual,
We played in the backyard.
Okay.
So the neighbors had to hear it. We didn't have a garage, because it was base housing, so nobody had a house. It was Danny's room was one place, and then our backyard with a fence was another place.
Because I remember so many bands in those days would play in the garage and just they'd open the door and the neighborhood kids would come around. Right. It was almost like you had a concert.
That's in a neighborhood, right.
Yeah.
On Air Force housing, it's like 8-plex where it's a giant long building and 8 families live in it, you know, upstairs, downstairs.
Mm-hmm.
And so everybody has their own apartment inside, so there's no garages.
Now, kids today don't really have that. Like, bands aren't important to kids today. So what do kids get together and scratch records in their backyard? You know what I mean? Do they get together and
you guys quit walking over there? Walk.
You stop that! I'm trying. Do they get? You know what I mean? We used to get together and bring your guitar, bring your drum, uh-huh. bring your bass. I'll bring my tambourine. What are these guys? I'll bring my turntable.
Yeah.
I'll bring my turntable. We'll sit. We're getting.
Well, I've heard some really great guys that don't have any instruments. It's all mouth. Where, you know, 4 or 5 guys get together. Did you hear them? Yeah.
Yeah.
And they do trumpet sound slash drum sounds. I mean, it's
that's
really
kind of cool.
It is cool. I mean, so that expression was like the first expression, was the musical expression.
I think that comes out of poor people necessity.
What?
You know, that you can't afford instruments.
Oh, yeah, sure.
But you kind of want to be a band. You kind of want to be a band, and you get sort of like, what can we do? We could make fart noises with our hands. And
well, that's in the South.
Yeah, there's spoons.
Well, I mean, my grandfather played a jug.
See, that's what I'm saying. It's musical necessity just created a band of
my father stuff. Played spoons.
Did he really?
Yeah. So, you know, my aunt played harmonica, and my grandfather played accordion also. I had another uncle that played accordion, and then 4 uncles that played guitars. So growing up, when I went down to South in Texas and in Louisiana around my dad's family, it was Cajun music.
Yeah.
So to sit around and listen to music and listen to the cadence, listen to the highs and the lows of the songs. So it just, I think that musical thing worked for me later as a comic also.
It gave you your meter, your, uh-huh.
Correct. There's beats.
Because I do believe that too. I've told other comics, I think that there's a rhythm to comedy just like music. If you can get it going, you keep riding it, and if you stumble, there's that, like, if the song skipped, it's that same kind of like, we were with you. Okay, right, kind of lost it. Okay, we're back.
Just continue, Yeah, I've always looked at it that way. I've always brought in that musical side of myself for the rhythm of stand and storytelling. You know, Justin Wilson, growing up listening to, remember Justin Wilson albums? You know,
the guy.
I guarantee, yeah. And just listen to the way he told jokes. And Bob Newhart, you know, I think Justin even did some of Bob's jokes. But it was totally different with the Cajun slant to it.
Right.
You know what I mean? Because I didn't know this till I got older and realized.
Boudreaux and somebody
stories. Yeah. Right. The great goose hunt, you know, and all that stuff that they had.
Who was that other comic, you know, the old guy that used to do all that stuff from home? Wazzy! Remember that old.
South?
Yakima. Yazoo, Mississippi, or somebody?
Was he a sound effects guy?
No, it's just an old guy that told, like, he was always stories? on the southern thing. I can't remember his name, but it always reminded me of the Justin Wilson. But they always, those guys told those stories, like, they yes. were joke stories.
Yes. And I think they did a lot of each other's
stories.
The same
kind of stuff. Uh-huh. But I think that's why so many people tell us even, oh, you're a comic.
Tell me, because
we don't do that anymore. Right, comedy does not consist of...
It's an expression of something from
you. So these two rednecks walk into a bar.
Right, yeah. Yeah, make it specific for an area.
Yeah.
And back then they did, because they didn't have clubs, so they worked what did they have back then? Music halls? Where did those guys perform? You know, Justin Wilson's and
I think it was bars, theaters, county fairs,
right.
kind of anything.
I mean, they had to do a whole different thing, you know, and it had to be clean and, you know. And then, you know.
The guy that I'm thinking of, I keep talking about my head, he would always go, oh! Huh. Do you remember that guy at all? He'd go, in the middle of a story.
Okay.
Somebody listening will probably let us know, but that was.
Andy Griffith?
No, but there was another one
style,
of those
right?
storytelling
right,
guys.
Right. Well, you know, my dad, you know, loved stand-up, so I was raised on all kinds of albums. But, I mean, the big break when it just snapped was for me, was late 60s with Red Fox and LaWanda Page albums.
Uh-huh.
Do you remember how nasty those
were?
Oh,
I do.
I mean, it was like finding porno.
Oh.
It was.
It was, and they actually did those kind of jokes like, I'm going to go find me some new pussy. You could find something here if your dick was longer.
Mm-hmm.
You know, you're like, oh my God, did they say that?
Right.
They said that on an album?
Yeah. Yeah. And Knockers Up?
Yeah.
Remember Knockers Up?
Yeah. What was her name? The music lady. I remember her.
Every adult had that then.
My parents had that album.
Uh-huh.
Mm-hmm.
And that was late 60s. Every adult had it. And it was so funny because, man, when they left, you could play it.
Uh-huh.
And then I found Bill Cosby and
Why
his
is there
storytelling.
Air?
Yes. Now, snakes, I'm going to get out the bed. Don't bite me. You can bite me a little bit, but don't put none of your juice in it. Remember that?
Yeah.
You know, I mean.
Those guys could not even start today.
Right.
I don't even think, in the way comedy is today, and as fast-paced as it has to be, and the MTV edit of people's brains, you think Newhart or those guys could come out and sit down and tell a story?
But they were timely for us because that stand-up thing had been broken. The mold had been broken. Vaudevillian style and everybody was so safe and clean. And then all of a sudden these guys started breaking out of the mold and becoming themselves and weren't afraid. And Carlin kind of changed his whole direction. And Pryor, of course, was, just set the place because he wanted to be Bill Cosby.
Yeah.
And so, Jimmy Walker tells some great stories. I love talking to Jimmy Walker. I love him. I got to know him real well, and his stories about what the comedy was like for those guys in the 60s, mid-60s, and the working at, they'd have like clubs, so they did Playboy clubs, and they did these music rooms
right.
and things like that, where people would go out to dinner, have drinks, and watch a show. And that was their...
Did they still want the adult stuff, or was this the time when they were still being cleaner?
No, this was still when they were being cleaner. But then those guys started to attract that attention, and then, they made other rooms for them. They made their own crowd. They made their own audience. But, and Pryor got fed up with himself because he realized he was going to be a Bill Cosby.
Yeah.
And he just, snapped and started talking about the truth of who he was and where he was from, and... His mom was a hooker. He's from Peoria, Illinois. And, all of a sudden he talked the way he wanted to. And he created
that. And it blew up.
Yeah, imagine what all those comics around saw that, though. I mean, that's why.
Didn't the same thing happen to Carlin, though? And
yeah.
Wasn't it the
same? He was inspired by that. He saw the same thing.
I can't.
Yeah, he was doing the hippie dippy weatherman and doing all the TV shows. But I think there's something inside all of us. It's like being a songwriter also. It's like you can write hits or you can write a song you want to write.
Yeah.
About something you've lived. And then that turns into a hit because it's so different.
It's so real. It came out
exactly.
Of you.
So I think, one of the things about doing stand-up is purity. I mean, it's just like music. If you can get to the point where you can write pure, where there's just no chain of melting it down before it gets out to people. Just here it is. And it's coming out of your character / your
right.
real person, whatever. Because, the stage is just the best of who we are.
Yes.
That's up there. That's my personality. But it's heightened. You know what I mean?
Do you feel like you're Do you have some shows that you feel like you're performing, you're like you're going to go do your stuff, and then other shows you feel like...
It can be helped, yeah.
It comes out of it. Like, I don't even know where that came from. No. I wish I would have taped that because...
And it's from doing it so much. And it's from working the muscle and from, you know, travel and getting to a place where you got so much in your mind.
That I saw two or three things today that I just want to talk about.
And that's where it goes. And when you do those, it's like out of body, isn't it?
Totally out of body.
And that's why we chase that our whole lives.
You can't even remember what you said. Even.
And that's why a comic does it, because there's nirvana in this. And when you can step in nirvana and just be yourself and then be shocked by what comes out of you, because you not only love where it's coming from, but you know it was magical.
Right. Like this, yeah. This sounds so weird. It probably doesn't even make sense. But last night... I've done a bit, you know, I've done a bit for years about going to Denny's after drinking.
Okay.
And I just said a lot. It just came off my tongue last night. And like, just let me have my eggs, and I will continue on my journey.
Uh-huh.
And there was a big laugh.
Right.
It was a big, big laugh. And I don't know where it came from.
Right.
It was some tag that just came out of me, and it was just.
Because you've done it enough that you didn't think about it, you just let it be,
and
right?
I continue on my journey.
I love that spot.
And I was just, it felt so
material,
good.
The material,
it felt good to me.
Made it a bit different to you.
It made the connected bit with them. Made the bit new to me.
Uh-huh.
And all of a sudden, like, I remember that line for whatever reason, just for like, why was that even in my head?
Right.
And I will just continue on my journey. You know, it feels good.
It's like tagging a Beatles song. You know, it must have been like when they couldn't figure out a line.
Yeah.
And then John or Paul said, "How about this?"
Oh my
God, that's perfect. The weight's on your shoulders. Got it. Da 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 da. That's good, John.
Write that down.
You know what I mean? It's the same thing, man. It's just being creative, letting it flow, riffing on it, getting up on stage with an idea because you know how to play the instrument. So just get up there and let it go. And I'm only saying this because we deal with so many young comics that hear these things and they want to talk to us about it, you know?
And they are so word for word.
Yeah.
They got their little pad and they're writing and they're word for word.
Which is fine.
Yeah.
Set yourself up and get over the fear of doing stand-up.
Do you write down stuff at all?
No,
do you? I don't either.
No,
I mean, I talk into my phone.
Right.
I'll make myself a note.
Right.
I don't.
It's very small stuff.
I'm not writing and rewriting
and
changing this word because that's better. Or
I used to script out. I used to script everything out word for word and then I memorized it.
Like a play.
Like a play. And then I performed it to where it was second nature to me. You know what I mean? So that way the shows would change up every so often. But that was scripted out. And then I think after about six years of doing it, I quit writing altogether and I started training myself to remember it.
Yeah. You know? Now, I remember...
We're performing on a nightly basis.
Right.
So
now, I remember years ago, you were one of the first guys down in Houston. You took a gig that was like a nightly host gig.
Sheridan.
Is that what it was? Down in a showroom?
It was a Sheridan showroom. Well, it was a Sheridan bar, actually, and they did entertainment on Friday and Saturday.
Uh-huh.
And I don't remember how I got it. Somebody saw me at the club and asked me if I would... be the MC down there on the weekends.
Right.
So, I mean, we were in it like 5 or 6 months. But remember what I was doing before that? I was stripping.
Yeah, I do.
Remember that?
I do. But that didn't last long, though, did it?
3 months.
Okay.
3 months. But, I mean, I made ungodly money. I was 20. 21. You're turning 21. So a friend of mine, Kevin, we used to go and hang out there every weekend. And I did comedy dancing. I didn't do striptease like the other guys. The other guys were...
Like Thunder from Down Under.
Exactly. Yeah, exactly. I mean, we had those guys.
You were Punchline from Anaheim.
But they were gay or couldn't get out of a mirror. You know, like you're walking out of a room and there's a mirror. Like, I think you're dancing next, Bob. Bob? And he's just staring at himself, you know. It's like, so that was the kind of guys. And remember, you know, I'm a comic.
Yeah.
We're performing, 5 days a week back then?
Yes.
At that little club? And on weekends, I would do the first show at the comedy club. And then Kevin and I would run down to the Deja Vu Club.
Right.
And I would dance from, I think it was on Friday and Saturday nights at 12 o'clock, I think 12 to 3. It was men dancing for women. And that's where I overcame sexual fears. And, you know, I was not very worldly.
But you got worldly pretty quick there.
Oh, yeah. Because I took advantage of the situation, you know. Yeah. And Kevin did, too. And so I had girlfriends for the, you know, different girlfriends. And I had to learn how to shed them off because Saturday was coming. You know what I mean? I mean, that
hey,
kind of guy.
Hey, Friday, you know, girlfriend, you have to
well,
leave.
Well, they were just in it for the sex, you know. So, and I, you know, I had my first older women experiences and those kind of things. Twins, triplets. I had, like, these sexual moments that were just phenomenal for a 20, 21-year-old kid.
And thank God that's all behind you now.
And they were just using me. Well, it actually is behind me.
Okay, but this, my point where I was going with this showroom, because I remember just being amazed that you would go down there night after night and create new
material.
New material.
And that's something I've done my whole career. Because I took improv classes when I first started as an actor. So one of the things I always promised myself is I would never get bored with my act. So whenever I've gotten to a point, you know, where I've got a show that I've had for 3 years, mm-hmm. and it's time for the next show, because you've traveled with it enough, then that's where the improv starts coming in. But what's interesting is every, you know, 5, 6, 7 years, you've turned into a different person. So these things that used to be topics for you are no longer topics. Or if they are, again, a topic in your present show.
You can bring
show,
them back around.
It's a whole different experience mm-hmm. that you get to talk about worldly things and things that we all live and see. And
right. But don't,
every day.
Now, do you?
So anyway, the actor's training
helped,
the improv
helped in that
really
show.
Helped me. So one of the challenges I gave myself, since I had to do it every single weekend for those months I had that job, was that I wasn't going to do the same thing twice. So that was just a personal artistic promise. So I would have to write all week. I would have to take notes. I would have to go in and be confident and sell it to an adult bar crowd. Also remember, we were the 20, 21-year-old guys back then
right.
performing to 35 to 55-year-olds.
Because uh-huh.
this was a bar at the Sheraton where businessmen stayed. I mean, do you ever remember anybody your own age being in the bar at these hotel gigs?
No.
You
not,
know what I mean?
Not at all.
So
yeah.
We had to be mature enough to not be goofy kids, but come across professional so that the club said, you know, I really like you. You got a gig here, and I think it paid $250 a week.
It was good. I remember you had making good money and buying nice clothes. You had to get some nice clothes.
Yes.
Everybody's like, Carl's doing well.
Yeah.
Carl's doing
well. Well, I also had stripper money that I could spend, too. Man.
That's true, too. You come in and make it rain up in there and stuff. Now, what are some of your first memories, though, of the Comic Annex in Houston? What is your some of your
The first one is performing in that room where they did their play.
The one next door, not
yeah,
the actual.
Yeah, not the annex, yeah. That experience, that first-time experience was just, I felt like I had found a home, as odd as that is. I just left home to come because of a newspaper article, so mm-hmm. I just left home to do it. I was living in my car, by the way. I had a station wagon, and I cleaned it out, and I had a futon in the back seat and my guitar. So I would sleep down by Rice University baseball field. And then I would play guitar near the campus and on campus with my guitar case open. And that's how I picked up $5 to $30 a day. So I used to go in and eat at Denny's and then go in their bathroom and shower with a rag. You didn't know that.
I didn't know that.
Yeah.
I did not know that.
Uh-huh. I didn't have a place. So for me, going to the annex when it was completed and built, I think it seated 60 or 80. 80?
I think 80.
Okay.
Yeah. I just remember being very small
right.
by today's standards.
Yeah, exactly. But back then, I remember it as a big room.
I do too. I remember thinking, oh my God, look at all these people tonight.
Exactly.
This place is packed.
Uh-huh. And there was 50 people in there.
Yeah.
And then when it did start selling out, like a month or two later, when it really became a consistent sellout all the time.
Around the building, line
around
the building.
The building.
And people would wait and
uh-huh.
knowing they weren't going to get in.
Uh-huh. I mean, that was magical, but also I think the time. I mean, I loved all you guys. I loved all the other comics I'd met. I loved their stories. I loved, you know, I just felt like I'd met a new family, and I belonged there. And so that's the initial vibe. I bet if we went back, I know it's not there now, but I mean, if we were to go back to that car wash that it is now and walk through that room or see it again, it would look so tiny to us because of what we've done since.
Right.
But,
the 400 seat rooms at a club. And,
right. And all the Vegas stuff. Let me turn this down. I heard it ding.
Oh, that's it. Yeah, mine dinged while we go to. Everybody's got our phones going off and stuff. Now, do you remember who was on stage or who was around the club that first night that you that you came in?
The first night I came in, I remember Steve Epstein because he was Ronald McDonald.
Uh-huh.
I remember that in his intro. But I think the first time I was there, we all performed. We had to showcase. They had a comedy night.
Right.
When they were just about to start building that place.
Mm-hmm.
So I did it once there and decided I was going to...
I only started at the Annex. Okay. I went to the side.
Oh, but you did. Okay.
But I didn't
The Annex
start.
Was already open.
Yes.
Okay. So when I did it, I remember Steve Epstein, Jack... Do I remember Jack... I think it's Jack Mayberry. I remember performing. Somebody was in radio. I remember their intro. And then...
Jack Mayberry was radio.
That's what it was. And then Kinison and Sam. I remember his set specifically just because I was from the same background. I was raised the same way.
Uh-huh.
So I really saw his cadence and his jokes, the Jesus jokes
and the preacher,
and stuff.
And the preacher format.
I saw the preacher in him and stuff. And so, but what was funny is when I got off stage, I went on Fifth that night. And when I got off stage, I went back and I brought a girlfriend with me. And we were sitting in the back booth. And I was just in heaven. I mean, I just loved the club vibe. I loved the feeling of it. And, you know, I'd never done it. You know, so it was just really, really life-changing for me. So I'm glowing in this back thing. And guy walks up in a suit and said, "Hey, you're really good." And I said, "Thank you very much." He goes, "Are you going to come back next week?" And I go, I'm thinking about it. He goes, "Good, my name's Sam. I'm a comic, too." And he was in a suit. I thought he was the owner.
I thought I got discovered.
You know what I mean? But I had enough experience as an actor to know that, you know, this was a new thing and that a club wasn't going to do that. They were going to open a room. I heard that rumor that they're going to open a room next door. And that little room was magical, man. I think it just set the tone for all of us.
Mm-hmm.
In many ways. Now, I don't think any bad stories came out, even though we were all young and full of piss and vinegar and fought, you know, a lot and argued a lot and this and that. We also shared a lot. We also went out and ate Chinese all the time and
we're constantly at International House of Pies.
Yes, right.
Where all the transvestites used to hang out.
That was fun. God, that was fun. So, you know, I mean, I think I'm bringing this back to a question you asked me earlier. Have I ever felt like anything passed me up? No. I think everything I've ever been a part of has been absolutely magical. Just that when they ended, it turned out that somebody else was famous that died or whatever. But when you live it, you're not thinking about any of that. You're living the moment of
it.
So no, I've never felt like I was passed up or a time. Did I miss anything? And as we talked about earlier, I don't think you miss any opportunities in life. I think you change so much that every time you change, that next place is a great opportunity to create success in that persona, that age.
Right. You know? And don't you think what we've done is probably one of the best lives you could ever
have? I wouldn't trade it for anything.
Anything.
If it ended right now, I've already had a great life.
Think of the things you've done and seen and been in and TV shows and and famous friends.
Sure.
And you know,
the parties and the people you've met on the road.
Yeah.
The people that you've become family with for 30 years in each city that you know and love now. That were just, you met them at a club when you were 25.
Right.
You know?
And aren't you still amazed or have other people be amazed at who you know?
Because
my girlfriend will just be like, "What?"
Yeah.
Who called you? I go, "Oh, yeah. No, he's in this movie."
We don't know pretentious people.
No.
That's another thing about us, too. And I think this is, I don't know if it's Texas or what, but we don't have pretentious friends. Some of our friends are famous, but they're not assholes.
No.
They're just great people. And that's why we give them ourselves and they give to us.
Yeah.
You know, it's like, kindred spirits, you know.
I remember the first time that, you know, it was like Brad Garrett had, talked to my girlfriend and I. I'd known Brad for years.
Sure.
But she's like,
of course, you
know Brad?
Yeah.
I've known him for years. He's such a nice guy. Yeah, he's such a nice guy. And it's that kind of, they're amazed at the people you know. Or mm-hmm. if you watch a movie and you go, he and I did a show in Atlanta together.
Right.
What? Yeah. Hey, I'll text him. Hey, congrats on the movie.
Uh-huh.
Text back at the, she's like,
right.
Oh my God.
Yeah,
it's like, we just know people, but it did never get given to you.
Right.
You
know? That's, I think that's what you think is success is. How are you gauging this miraculous life that you created? That's how I look at it.
And we did. You created it. You created it.
I left home.
You left home. You lived in your car.
I starved for it. I robbed for it. I did a lot for what I'm doing. So nobody can take any of that from me. I did it, and I love it. That's why I smile a lot. That's why I give a lot. That's why I'm courteous. That's why I don't mind answering questions to a guy just starting out. And I can go hang out with my friend who owns all the clubs in the country and, you know, does movies.
Exactly.
Because I know who I am.
And isn't it amazing that I did this one day. You look around and you think, I wrote jokes that paid for this.
Uh-huh.
I'm sitting on a couch that I told a joke and I got a check for. That's amazing to me.
And what's interesting now is to hear all of our stuff on satellite, you know, Sirius and stuff, and get these checks and stuff and go, oh man, I'm getting to live out two fantasies. I want to be a musician fantasy. So here's my residual checks from my songs, my hit songs.
They're on the radio. Yeah, right. They're apparently on a radio somewhere.
Right.
Yeah, there's nothing better than that sound exchange check. When it surprises you that you're like, wow, I got $500. They're playing me somewhere.
Do you know Steve Hurst?
Yes.
I got to tell you this because I just thought of it and I didn't even tell my brother this story yet. Last weekend he was playing here at Fort Worth at the club and I went to see him and I haven't seen him in probably 8 years. And when I first met him, I really liked him a lot and so I let him travel with me. So I had him as my opener for about a year. Every month he did 1 or 2, 3, 4 gigs with me, you know. And then he started getting gigs. And it's time, you know, I've taught you what I know. Go have fun, you know. I let another guy pass on in life, you know.
Travel on, Grasshopper. All right,
so you can only imagine that in a year how many conversations we had in hotel rooms late night with pizza after doing these shows. So I see him last weekend and we're talking and I said something to him. I go, hey, man, we're living our dreams, aren't we? And he goes, let me tell you something, Carl. He goes, you know, when I first came from England, I came over here and I was starving. I was in a hotel and I was watching TV and the Tonight Show came on and it was, you know, Jay Leno. And I don't know who Jay Leno is. You know, who the hell's Jay Leno? He's from London. He don't know our talk show guys. He goes, so I'm watching this Jay Leno. It's all right. It's all right. They got a singer and stuff on. It's all right. And then this comedian comes out. And this comedian changed my whole night. Like, he just brought an energy to the show. It just exploded. His ovation was phenomenal. Jay went nuts for him. And I did, too. And I went, I want to do stand-up comedy. If it can be done like that, I want to do stand-up. I went, wow, that's cool. Who was the guy? And he goes, it was you. You were the first comic I ever saw on TV in America.
Wow, that's pretty cool.
And it blew my mind because I was 7 years ago, we hung out every day.
And he never
shared that story with me.
Maybe he was in awe. It's one of those that he just didn't want to, I mean, kind of an equal. Yeah. Did you ever feel like that when you're around a celebrity?
Sure.
You don't want to feel like, you know, I bought your album in high school and you're the reason I even picked up
you
a
tell
guitar.
Him later. Yeah. Although, you know, I have ruined it and done it the first minute you meet somebody when I was really young.
You just blurted it out.
Oh, yeah. I can't believe I'm meeting you. I've been that guy, you know, so I understand it. All it takes is once and you learn your lesson.
Well, I've avoided it for this long.
Okay.
And do you want to bring it?
9.5 inches.
Okay. That's all I wanted to know.
Nice.
That explains your career in dancing. Well, what I was going to say is our mutual dude. I'm trying to be. Do you want to say Sam? I want to talk about Sam for a second. And I don't want to do this because I love you as much, and I know you've had trouble and stuff.
Right.
But the same guy that he's the reason I'm in stand up.
Okay.
That's where I was going to go with this.
Yeah.
For whatever hassles that he's done, he's actually the reason that...
Listen, Sam was a comedy. He was a genius. I mean, he loved it. So I would, you know, I've let him go. I've forgiven the things he did to me as a person, you know, because I just realized, I got to the point one day where I realized he became an alcoholic and he became a drug addict and he became lost in power and a lot of things, because we don't know what his upbringing was. I mean, I do, but yeah. People don't know his upbringing. So when he finally got to a place where he was, you know, mobbed and girls wanted him and all that stuff, well, it changed him, because he had never had any of that.
Yeah.
And I'm not talking normal celebrity. I'm talking, you know, he was a rock and roll celebrity. We created that rock and roll style on purpose because we were musicians. So we hung out with, you know, music. And we wanted to be the same guys. We wanted to be the Beatles. We wanted to share women. We wanted to fucking play that late night game where we did coke off every titty we could and screwed all the women at night, you know, and still maintain marriages and girlfriends and, you know. We wanted all of our cake.
Right. We wanted it all.
But that's how people that are lost in drugs and alcohol think.
Right. Right.
Well, that it's never going to end. And it ended. And when after it ended, then I found out more things that he had done to me and to my ex-wife. And, all you know, and it put me in a crisis of memory because... You know, you got. I was with Sam when he made it. When he became Sam, I was with him the day that he screamed for the first time on stage because of, you know, of anger, of built up.
Like real scream, not his typical. No,
the first time you said, "Are you married? Are you ever thinking about getting married? Remember this face?"
Oh yeah,
I picked him up from the house because he was married to Terry. Remember her?
Right, I do.
Well, he married her, but you know he didn't love her and he was using her, so he had to live a lie. And she knew it was becoming obvious that he was lying to her by, you know, taking her money to survive. She had a great job and she was a great lady. But to take her money and then to stay out all hours of night, every night, because he wanted to be a, you know, comic. Yeah. So he was living the comedy dream and he hardly saw her. And she moved to L.A., you know, to be with her husband.
Right.
Who she met in church when he was a preacher. So that's how she knew him. You know what I mean?
Mm-hmm.
So now he's got this, he's living two personalities, and they got in a big fight, and I picked him up, and we were driving to the club that night. We were doormen. We hardly ever got spots. But one day, you know, we knew it was coming, and he just was quiet on the way over. And I said, you know, what, you want to talk? He goes, I created it, you know. I'm just in it right now. Real solemn. And we get to the club, and we weren't there half an hour, and second, third act, canceled. Arsenio's not coming in. Sam, you're on next, you know. So I was like, oh, and I just saw like, oh shit, now I gotta think like an artist. And so he went up, because he didn't have that Sam act yet, you know. And he went up and he just dropped it. And I went, where's he going with this? He didn't do what he normally did, which was corny anyway. And he goes,
where are the fucking cops?
And he goes, you're having a good time, aren't you? And he was just being still pissy. But he put it in character. And the kid goes, yeah. He goes, you've seen a lot of good comics up here, huh? He goes, yeah. And it made him uncomfortable because now Sam's staring him down. He goes, you ever think about getting married? Well, how long have you been with her? Oh, about 6 months. Well, if you ever think about getting married, just remember this face. And he just released that fight he had 2 hours earlier.
Just screamed in the kid's face.
Just screamed in his face. And then I saw Sam lit up. I saw his eyes. I saw his... You know, his persona, just his body became erect, you know. And we all know that from art. Whenever you come into something, you know, it's like doing that bit for the first time and all of a sudden you realize, there's my ending from now on.
Right, there's my closer. Right. There's the closer. Okay, well, I needed that.
He discovered his persona and his thing right then and there. And I saw it. I was in the back room doing the door like we did every single night for 3 years. He got it. And from that night forward, we started working on what follows that thing he did with the scream / because I've been married and you know what marriage is like. And then we wrote that part.
Right.
And so, you know, he wrote, I didn't write all this material.
He did the little song.
That came a year and a half later. But we had the ideas grew just from that one happy accident.
Yeah.
Of just like, I don't want to perform tonight, so I'm going to just go up and not give a shit. And in that became the happy accident that opened the door of, wait a minute, I'm the guy going through hell in marriage.
Yeah.
I've already been divorced. I'm probably going to get divorced again, which he did. And it set the tone for that's who I'm going to speak to.
Yeah.
And his own path. So nobody, so I understand when people say, you know, he's the reason. I sure do. I get it, man.
Well, Sam for me was, I was doing the Comedy Annex at night, working at the Houston Chronicle during the day. I was, like you said earlier, we were all friends. We're all hanging out. We're at everybody's apartment. Yep. Pineapples cooking gumbo. We're staying up all night.
Right.
And I just couldn't do it anymore. I had to pick one or the other. I was either going to lose my job at the paper or I was, and I told Sam, I said, I think I'm just going to have to, you know, cut back on this. And he was like, no. Okay. This is what you need to be. You need to do stand-up. This is what you need to do. I've watched you. This is it. You know, I've watched you structure jokes. You've gotten. This is what
That's right.
And he actually is the one that talked me into staying with comedy and leaving the other behind. Because he told me, you reached your dream as a cartoonist.
Yes.
That's what you went to school for. That's what you wanted to be. You've done that. Well, don't you want to have a new dream?
Uh-huh.
And he gave me this whole little deal. Uh-huh. I'm like, you're right. Yeah. I want to keep, life should be these goals that you set,
mm-hmm.
and you go to the next one.
One of the most motivational-minded people that I knew back then was Sam. When I first met, because, you know, I was a runaway. I just found out my father was gay. It destroyed my whole family. I'm the oldest of three. It destroyed us. We all went our own ways because our dad was our hero. And the way it was presented to us was not by my father. It was presented ugly. And it just, I was shocked because my life felt like a lie, like I'd been raised in a lie.
It was your mom that told you, right?
My mom told me, but she told me angry. So she didn't say, you know, your father's always been gay and I've known it. And, you know, he's got to live his own life now. And she didn't do it that way. You know. Your father's a fag. And so, and as a young 20-year-old guy.
Had it blown her mind, too? Is that what had happened?
Huh?
Did it totally have blown her mind, or was it something that she did know?
No, it was something that she did know. Okay. But he had gotten to a point where he just wasn't hiding it anymore from her. And I guess she knew it going in. She told me on her deathbed she knew it going in. So she died a couple of years ago, and I had a great week with her before she died because we cleared up so many things. So, by the way, if somebody in your life is getting sick, it's the time to, you know, just be honest and brutally truthful, and it sets both of you free, because it did her too. Because I judged her and hated her for many years for a lot of things growing up. Yeah, you know, gave me the anger that I used in stand up and acting and a bunch of other stuff. But I also realized she's the one that gave me my survival skills. You know, I slept in cars, I slept on the streets, and I dated women I did not like. And I did a lot of things because I saw this life.
Yeah.
You know, and nobody else saw it for me.
How old were you at the time when you found out about your dad?
Well, I just turned 20. So
that really was right there at that, the entire...
3 weeks later, I was
with
you guys, living in my car. And Sam taught me forgiveness. And that's why I love Sam so much as my friend. He taught me how to forgive my father. He sat me down one night. He already knew the story. Because I was closer friends with his brother, Kevin, because we were the same age.
Mm-hmm.
And when I met Kevin, because Kevin wasn't there when I first did stand-up. And then when I came back, like 5 months later, the club was open. You guys were already entrenched in like 4 or 5 months of the club.
Yeah, yeah.
And so I was the new guy the second time around. Yeah. And Sam introduced me to all of you guys. And it took me like a week to get my comedy chops back because I've been working in a steel mill and a gas station and saving up my money for that stupid station wagon. But that was my home, and I knew it was going to be. So I saw that. You know, I envisioned that I'd sleep in my car. And so Sam, you know, slowly became a friend of mine. Because he was 5 years older than me, and he was very mature, and he could be very dark or solemn. He didn't like me and Kevin smoking pot, and I was just discovering pot. And me and Kevin liked to smoke, and he just didn't get it. And so I talked him into it one night. I said, smoke it. And I go, you know what? You're pretty heavy, too. Why don't we take a walk? I go, listen, why do you need to be a fat guy? We're up late at night, and you eat. And eat and eat, and then you go to bed. Why don't we eat and then go do an hour walk every night? Remember that? And then we got on that weight loss thing where he started losing weight because I was in shape. I was playing semi-pro baseball down in League City. Remember when we played the softball teams? I was playing the
I remember everybody being semi jealous of Carl, because Carl was like, you know, just...
Well, I was little and fast and strong. I was lean, you know?
Yeah. Wiry.
Yeah. And I was full of anger. So I was that little guy waiting to go off on somebody at all times. But I was nice, but I was still looking for somebody to go off on, because I didn't know what to do with this turmoil that I couldn't share with you guys. You weren't close enough to me to know why I was there living in my car. And it was all meant to be, you know, it's just the way it was. And Sam taught me within the first 6 months of knowing him how to forgive my father. And it brought my whole family back together. So that was pretty powerful.
So Sam has had this positive influence on you.
Absolutely.
Positive. And then you find out some things.
And then I found out he fathered my daughter a year after I died. After he died, I found out that he had fathered my child.
And that had put you now on this path of father rights. And
paternity fraud and trying to change the law so that people that find out that they're not the father of a child can get their life back. And I've been battling that for since 89, 90, geez, I'm so sorry. I got the date wrong. 97 is when I started this whole thing. But my life changed when I went on Howard Stern in 2000 and told the whole story. Then, 2006.
Opened it up and let
2006, I told the story on Stern. And that was the first time I told everybody my story. And up till then, it was just family and really close friends that knew.
I had
this anger. I'd go everywhere and people want to tell me these great Carl Sam stories, you know. I saw you and Kinnison and it was you guys were nice to me, man. I remember I snuck backstage and you guys offered me some chicken. I remember that because you guys had all that food back there. You said, here, grab some chicken, take off. I thought that was cool. You know?
And you were supposed to be like, okay, that was great because we're buddies.
Well,
and...
Yeah, but fresh off finding out Sam had fathered my child, and then, of course, it ruining... You know, that part of my life. That's how I look at it now. It just kind of ruined that part of my life.
I guess that's where I was going to ask you. How do you cope with the fact this guy had been your best friend forever, almost saved your life, put your family back together, and then does this? How do you justify in your head, or did at some point you go, that's Sam?
It's Sam, but I mean, at the same time, I have to look at it as somebody I chose to be my friend. I missed some of the signs. I was much younger, so I didn't know how to help him as a real friend. If I might have had 5 more years in my life, I would have had the life experience probably to tell him he was getting out of control or to tell him he needed to stop drugs. But I was younger, so I thought he was just as powerful as he thought he was.
Yeah.
Because I was the brother.
It's the Elvis thing. He didn't have anybody to say no.
Well, you couldn't say no to him. I mean, he just had a way about him. I mean, he would figure out a way to talk you into stuff. But he was destroying himself because of his pains. And the people he hurt in his life, and all that stuff that any human carries.
Yeah.
You know, how do I make up for this crap I've done earlier in my life now that I've grown into this person? You know what I mean?
That goes back to those 12 steps, and now I'm supposed to go back and make amends. I have to apologize to these people.
Exactly. And that's how the 12-step programs do it. But I'm talking about as a human being, when you evolve and you're no longer that guy anymore, you know, how do you make up for some of those asshole-y things you did, you know? Well, you make up for it by creating a new you and being wonderful to the next group of people and you know, just absolutely changing everything. Yeah. So I decided Sam didn't get the chance to be that guy. He died before that next growth would have been there for him, because I believe he would have come to me and said, I know you, I'm not going to be your friend anymore, but I got to tell you the truth. And he would have let the chips fall, because he would have been the father to a child. And I believe he would have grown into that.
Yeah.
Instead, he didn't get to get that far. He was an addict, and he was trying to hide all of his things that he was doing. And my ex-wife was an addict, so they're not anymore. So I'm not in that world anymore either. So in order to survive it, maybe I let it go and forgave all of it. But I think as a human evolving, I think it's just something you do.
This all came together in a head, though, right? I mean, at one point, it had to just come together and explode into you at one point, right?
Yeah.
You're
talking about the January situation?
No. If you want to. I'm just saying in your own head, it was a giant clash and you dealt with it. That's what I'm getting
well,
at.
Yeah. I mean, I've had clashes that were, you know, I became an alcoholic for a long time. I've ruined gigs. you know, that I was never welcome back to. I mean, my behavior.
I've never heard that about you.
Right.
Seriously, I've never heard of that.
No. Yeah, but I'm telling you, like any other person who falls.
Any other comic or band that's blown a gig.
Exactly, man. I mean, I've been through it. But that's why when I see it going on, I know there's a reason for that person's behavior that you can't get to. It's they're fighting the inside battle with themselves on how to handle something. So until they figure it out, they're a mess to be around. They're a fuck up to be around. They're like, oh my God, this guy's going to kill you. You know, he's too much. And I was too much for a very long time. And it cost me friendships and relationships and a lot of things. You know, it was a good 10 years that I put myself through. And then one day I just kind of woke up to it and went, this behavior is doing nothing but
is detrimental to everything and everybody.
Aging me and hurting people around me. And I just kind of saw it one day, you know. I'm very, I look at myself a lot. You know, I'm very introspective. I'm one of those guys that introspects.
Yeah.
I'm in that spectral thing.
I look in the mirror and I see the inside.
That's what I was trying to say, but differently.
Right. Have you come to any recent conclusions now about your career? Are you going to change something? Are you making something new?
Yeah, here's what I think is interesting, which I knew a long time ago, too. Do you remember when you first started how magical everything was?
Mm-hmm.
When you got your first gig?
Just seemed
when you started booking yourself.
Amazing.
When you got your first outfit that was you, and you went, oh, all right, this is my stage clothes. And all those kind of things. Remember that excitement?
Oh, yeah.
You know why it happened? Because you weren't worried about it. You were living. What I've just gotten back to recently is I just started living again. I really let the past be the past, and I'm living in the now. I'm surrounded. I live near my brother, Larry, and we're best friends, you know. It's great to have an adult relationship with my brother and his family, and that is my family, and they're my family. And so he's got a tattoo shop here in Fort Worth, Texas, called Tattoos by LeBove. He's the best artist.
Well, we have to go.
Me and you have to get one together. That'll be fun. But, you know, I go and hang out with him, and we talk and come up with great ideas, and we have several ideas now that we're about to put into place for next year that is giving to the community, which we've never done. So as adults, we're going, you know what? We've had great lives, and we have a position here with the family shop to do something. I have a position as a comic to do something with it. And so I can't say what it is yet, but that's our family plan, and and it's something that's going to make people very aware of our veterans that we're proud to do because we were raised in the armed forces.
Right.
Around these guys. And we lost a lot of, when we were young people, lost a lot of people that we knew in Vietnam / the other wars all along the way. So it's a thing that we want to do for families. That came just by being in this place that I'm now in where, you know, hey, let's just talk about it because it's going to happen. Let's create it. Like there's nothing to stop you. So I don't believe in age and I don't believe in that stuff, man, because every time you're at a different place of awareness, then you're going to bring somebody something very special in your performances. There's always an audience for that.
Yeah. And my mom said to me one time years ago, how long do you think you can do this? I mean, don't you remember the days when your parents thought you should have something to fall back on?
Sure.
You know, how long do you think you could do this? And I'm like, how old was Bob Hope? How old was George Burns? I think as long as you just keep living your life and doing things and find something new to write about or something new to be happy about, you just keep going.
Do you realize we spent our whole lives not knowing how we're going to make it through next month?
It's true.
We've lived our whole... And we are so used to it that if you just give up the fear of that, which we did...
Yeah, the universe will help you out.
The universe helps you because you're stepping out there walking on clouds. So it's got to keep creating clouds for you to walk on.
Yeah. How many times have you ever been like just sitting there thinking, man, I'm not going to have enough money to pay rent this month. I'm not going to have... Hey, can you do a $1,000 gig tomorrow night?
Be right there. Yep. Boom. Thank you, life. Yeah.
I mean, how many times does that happen? It's constant to me.
We've proven to ourselves that we can survive anything. Not because we're so special. It's just because we're out there making the steps. I hired a girl to clean the hall while we talk.
I just heard that.
I saw some crumbs when we were walking to your big hotel room here at the Hilton. I went, you know what? I ought to have that swept.
Yeah, right in the middle of our podcast. Thank you, Maria.
I'll keep paying.
Housekeeping. Oh, well, this has been fun. I'm glad that you decided to do this and tell some.
We've been
story.
Friends for so long, and this is absolutely great. But by the way, our conversations at lunch was just as good.
Amazing, too.
But it was the same conversation. So this, you know what I mean? I mean, we took it.
Yeah, to a little longer, a little farther. Yeah, and I appreciate that.
Yeah. I just know I'm going to go downstairs and my bike's going to be gone.
That guy in the wheelchair is going to have figured out how to straddle your bike. And he's going to be sitting out there preaching off of your bike.
My helmet will be sitting on his little wheels.
Well, how do people find you? Do you have a website? Are you websiting and tweeting?
No, I'm not. I got a website that I let die because... child services for the paternity fraud were chasing me down at all my gigs. I'm just Facebooking and tweeting. So I'm Carl_LeBov.
And they can find you there?
And Facebook, Carl LeBov.
And for gigs, do people just go...
post on my Facebook.
Okay.
Yeah. I don't have any... My dates are not up anymore.
Yeah, I don't do that either. Can I have a list of your shows?
People always write you, or when you go into a town, you put out an email, hey, I'm headed to Vegas. You know, I always do it a couple days before I go.
Aren't you ever shocked that you'll perform somewhere and it's been posted on your Facebook and then the day you leave, well, I didn't know you were there.
Because I do that all the time. For like maybe 2 months now, I haven't been reading anybody's feeds. I just go on and I click off all the people invited me to play Candy Crush.
Are you unfriending those people now too?
No, I'm not unfriending them because I know they're not doing it on purpose. Because I got hooked on a game. Uh-huh. And I think what happens when you play, it says, do you want to tell your friends? And you don't, invite your friends? No, you don't do it. But I think it does it automatically sometimes. Oh. So a lot of these people that are doing that, they're not really tagging you to come play their game with them because you can't play with them.
Right. Well, see,
it's the advertising on the game does it.
Right. So I don't play any of these games, so I don't know. But I've always wondered if it was one of those deals, do you want an extra free life? Click, yeah. You know, do you get a free play? Do you get just invite? So people go, yes. So because I don't play those games, I don't know Candy Crush or Farmville or Mafia Town.
I like Titan Slots though. I got into Titan Slots or something on Titan Slots I like. So me and my brother are competitive.
What's it called?
Titan Slots.
Like machines, slot machines.
Yeah, and there's just one of the 190 games in there. We got addicted to. We like it, so we fell into that one game and. We've taken it, we play it in the morning and then we play it at night. And it's very funny. We're very competitive with adults playing.
Adults play video games.
Teenagers will walk by, God, look at the points he's got. Guy's like my grandfather and he's got like $1.8 billion.
Well, man, I appreciate you doing this. Yeah. We've talked for 1 hour and 10 minutes.
Wow.
It zoomed by.
It did.
We'll have to do it again. Next time I'm in Fort Worth, we'll sit down, we'll figure out the extra part of the story.
All right.
And we'll
take it over to my brother's tattoo shop. We'll do it there.
Yeah, we'll do it from the shop.
We'll do it there. That way we can have that noise, and he can jump in and say stuff while we're doing it.
Perfect.
Yeah.
Sounds perfect. All right, man.
I appreciate it.
Love you, too. See ya. And that Tiki Soldiers is one of the funniest guys in the business today, Mr. Carl LeBeauf. I hope you guys enjoyed the show today. I had so much fun talking to Carl, one of the geniuses in the business. And look for him when he comes to your city, and guarantee you'll have a gut-busting, laughing-ass good time. So, appreciate you. God bless America. Go listen to some Oak Ridge Boys. I bid you adieu.